Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we have a special show here in our Wisconsin Public Radio studios in Wausau. Our guests for the next hour are 7th District Republican Congressman Sean Duffy and his wife, television analyst and political activist Rachel Campos Duffy. Sean was first elected to Congress in 2010. He is now in his third term, representing the sprawling northern Wisconsin district. He is the former Ashland County District Attorney who grew up in Hayward and gained fame as a lumberjack competitor. Rachel has been a political analyst on the Fox News Channel and on ABC's The View and on other networks. She is the national spokeswoman for the Libra Initiative, an organization whose mission is the economic empowerment of Hispanics. She met Sean in 1998 when both of them were stars on MTV's The Real World. She is the author of Stay Home, Stay Happy, 10 Secrets to Loving At-Home Motherhood. Sean and Rachel now live in the Wausau area with their 7 children. I've wanted to do this show for a while and get to know the Duffys personally, to understand their family backgrounds, their values, and what motivates them in their public lives, instead of focusing the entire program on politics. Having said that, we will not completely avoid politics on this show. And if you've got a question for either Congressman Duffy or Rachel Campos Duffy, please give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That number again is 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it live on the air. Sean and Rachel, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Hey, Glenn, great to be here.
So how are the kids doing?
They're doing well. We have 7. Our oldest is 15 and a half, so she has her permits, which if anyone
almost
has taught...
Almost 16.
Almost 16, right. And dad's special stress trying to teach her how to drive, but it's going well.
And we have 6 in school and 1 at home. The baby's 1.5 now.
Well, Barbara Walters called you a cute couple.
She is so kind.
And Reince Priebus said about you, Sean, he's young, he's got great family, he's charismatic, he's smart, he looks good, he's the whole package. Sean is the future of America.
Wow.
Right. I guess Reince and I are pretty good friends. That was very kind of him.
Well, you seem to take the kids everywhere. In the last campaign, you all had those matching red plaid jackets, according to one story I read, and I did see the entourage a couple of times. It's great for a political campaign, but also probably a lot of fun for the kids.
Well, for us, it's important for our family because my job takes me to D.C. for at least 4 days a week. And when I'm back, I'm doing parades or fairs or festivals or town halls, touring, you know, businesses. And so if I don't take the kids, I don't get to spend time with them. So one, it's fun for them, but two, it's important for our family because we have to carve out whatever time we can to be a family. And that means sometimes they're on the road having some fun with their mom and dad.
Our kids, Glenn, think that parades are for passing out literature.
Right.
They've never really enjoyed one on the sidelines. So.
but it's got to be fun for
it
them.
It is. They rollerblade down it. And they, you know, for us, it's some of the kids weren't even born before, you know, Sean started running. So it's all they know. And actually, I think it's a really great opportunity for us as parents. It's been amazing to see them, you know, walk the halls of Congress, understand how the system works, see how Sean's job is so tied to our community, mm-hmm. and be a part of that. It's a great learning experience.
And I'd just say for us, I grew up in Hayward. I was log rolling and doing lumberjack shows. I had never been to D.C., really didn't go a whole lot of places in my youth outside of Wisconsin. And they have far different experiences than I think I had, and probably Rachel.
Neither one of us had been inside the Capitol building until after you were elected.
Yeah.
So.
Well, the plaid jacket, the axe, the whole lumberjack thing, it's become kind of a trademark with you, but a very effective one because it's rooted in your own personal history. You've got a couple of national championship titles.
Yeah, so I grew up in Hayward, and like many kids might take swimming lessons or diving lessons in the summer, I went and took log rolling lessons in Hayward. We have the largest lumberjack competition in the States, and actually in North America. There's some bigger ones over in Australia and New Zealand. But so I grew up doing the log rolling competitions as a young boy, and then I started doing lumberjack shows, and I learned how to speed climb, and that was really my love and my passion. It's kind of like the bull riding of the rodeo.
So speed climbing is how fast you can get up and down a tree.
Up and down, yep.
You're 41 years old now. Can you still do that?
I saw him do it this summer.
I'm 43, and it's amazing how we age, right? I'm not 26 anymore. I used to think that you didn't have to be in that great of shape when I was 26, but I try to do it now, and you know it's tough. I mean, you're bringing your whole body mass straight up a tree, and you're trying to go as fast as you can. But I can still do it.
Well, we've got a caller already. Let's go to Brad in Plover. Brad, you're on Route 51 with Sean Duffy and Rachel Campos Duffy.
Hi there. Rachel and Sean were both on several MTV reality shows back in the 90s, and if the people that had voted for Sean had watched their behavior on those shows, they would have never voted for Sean. They're both so self-righteous phonies, appearing on Catholic radio, but some of us know the truth.
All right, Brad, thank you so much for the phone call, and
Thanks,
I expected that one today. You were involved in reality television on MTV, and MTV could be raunchy back then, and it's even worse now. How do you square that with the moral stances the two of you have taken in your daily lives?
Well, listen, as everyone grows up, they sometimes will look back, whether they're in high school or college, in their youth, and as they mature, their values and their morals change. And I look back at some of the footage on MTV, and does it make me the proudest? No. And are those video clips used against me? And to Brad's point, all the clips that people may not like have been thrown up on all social media. But for me, listen, I met Rachel. We're the first reality TV couple, and had I not done those shows, I wouldn't have met her. And everything that Brad will say about me pales in comparison to meeting the love of my life and having seven kids with her.
Well, tell me about that, the two of you meeting. Rachel, how did it happen, and was it love at first sight?
It was not love at first sight for me. No, I'm kidding. So I was on the Real World San Francisco. Sean was on the Real World Boston. So there were two separate seasons, two separate years. But they had a reality show spinoff where they called Road Rules, where they take people on adventures. And they thought, wouldn't it be fun if we took one person from each of these casts and put them on a crazy adventure through America and New Zealand? And so Sean and I met at a train station in Vermont. And the first moment we met is actually captured on video, which is, you know, not a lot of people can say that. So that's kind of fun. And we met on the show. We liked each other. But it wasn't, you know, we're flirting and that sort of thing. But it was a few months later that we ended up really getting together. And we've been together ever since. It's been, we're going on 17 years now.
17 years of marriage.
Kind of
fun.
How do the two of you feel about reality television the way it is and about our popular culture, which is steeped in sex and violence and which can often be very, let's say less than moral?
Yeah. I first of all, I'm a reality TV fan, so.
I am not. I don't watch it, but
she does. He walks by and goes, why are you watching that? But I like to watch The Real Housewives. I like Bravo. I like reality television. But look, some of it's not good. Our own children, we don't let them watch that stuff. MTV is certainly not the way MTV was when we were young. It's definitely gotten to be more debaucherous over the years. And as parents, we have an obligation to at least in our own home control what our kids watch. Obviously, we're concerned. I'm very concerned about the sexualization of childhood for girls in particular, and how young that pressure is on them. Having girls, especially, I think, brings that to the forefront and makes it a top concern.
Well, MTV is all about that. That show they had for a while, Skin. It's pretty appalling stuff.
It is pretty bad. And I've been an advocate on television, often, you know, calling MTV out. I've often said that, you know, even shows like The Real World that have gotten, you know, to be, you know, where there used to be when we were on, it was a lot about, you know, putting kids together from different backgrounds, and it was a real political and sociological experiment. And now it's like, you know, hot tubs and sex. And I've told the executive producers, you know, myself, hey, I think you're underestimating young people. I think they want to go back to those kinds of interesting discussions.
Well, I was working in cable television in the 80s, and I remember when there actually used to be music on music television.
Yeah. We killed that.
But there has been a progression, not just on MTV, but on the major networks, on what they put on TV. And I think it's a sign of a changing culture. And what we did was pretty timid compared to what you see on there right now. And, you know, for us, we don't do any defense of MTV.
I would also say that another concern is our video games. In our home, we don't have those violent video games. They simply don't exist in our house. And I think our kids don't crave it because they didn't grow up with it. So I think there's a personal responsibility component to all of this. I mean, you can sit and you can, you know, get angry at the television or yell at it. But at some point, as parents, you have to take control.
And can I just one other point, too, with a lot of the young people who do The Real World but also other shows, they get some instant fame for not having any particular skill, but just they were selected to have their lives filmed. And
well, it worked out for you.
Well, but I could tell my dad was pretty hard on me, saying, "Listen, this does not mean you're something special. Go back to law school, finish law school, you know, make something of yourself." You see, a lot of the young people who do the shows, you know, they can go anywhere in the country, and that certain, you know, age range, everyone knows who they are. They move out to L.A. and they think they're going to be actors, and you know, they might have wanted to be a dentist or a veterinarian or a mechanic, and then they move to L.A. and you see a lot of reality TV stars languishing in L.A. trying to be something that they never dreamed they wanted to be, but they had this little shot at fame, and they don't want to let that up. And we came back. I finished law school. We moved to Hayward. I was practicing law and doing lumberjack shows, and I had a chance to be a DA. And it was, you know, after 10 years of MTV that we thought about running for Congress. So we've just done it differently.
And my parents were the same way. They, when the show happened, I was about to start graduate school, and there was a lot of, you know, I have immigrant parents, and, you know, it was very clear that, you know, at least my mother is an immigrant.
Let's talk about that. You're both you're devout Catholics, correct? The two of you?
Yes.
We try.
And you both came from large families.
We have seven kids, Glenn. We do the best we can.
You were the 10th of 11 children. And Rachel, you were one of 16 growing up in Arizona?
What? No, I'm one of four.
One of four?
One of four.
Where in the world did I see this?
I don't know. You know what? My father, yeah. You know, you probably went to Wikipedia. They say I'm Cuban, too. my father is one of 15. So maybe that's where that might have come from.
That's it.
I'm one of four.
Well, you know, as Abraham Lincoln once said, you can't believe everything you see on the internet.
You can't.
Was that Lincoln or Washington that said that?
Well, Sean, tell us about your family. You're one of 11 kids growing up in Hayward. What was that like? How did that mold your values?
Yeah, so I'm the 10th of 11 kids. There's a 20-year span between the oldest and the youngest, and I grew up in a really busy house because there were so many kids, and that means there's a lot of structure. There's a lot of chores, and you know, for me growing up, my dad he left Hayward and went to school at St. Thomas, and then ended up going to law school. But after he finished college, he married my mom, and he was working full time. They had six kids, and he was going to night law school. And I mean, they worked their tails off and didn't have anything. They were living in an apartment in, you know, a rough neighborhood in St. Paul. And he finished law school. They went back to Hayward, but they were able to do that through a lot of really hard work. And they've instilled that work ethic in all of their kids. And whether it's in the home or whether it's in school or it's in sports or in your first and second job, if you're going to make it in life or per the ideas of Tom and Carol Duffy, you're going to work hard.
Now, You're a conservative Republican politician, and your mom is driving around Hayward with a Feingold sticker on her car. Explain that to
Bernie me. Sanders, too, is
she
the
last
one. She has
Bernie
one I saw
on there, too.
Yeah.
So Bernie's on the back of the car, and the Duffy one is on the side door. I don't know how that comes to pass, but I got to tell you, I took a snap of the Bernie Sanders sticker on the back of her car and sent it to my conservative colleagues in the House, and they all got a good laugh out of that.
It says Bernie Sanders and Duffy.
And Duffy.
Your dad liberal or conservative?
My dad was a conservative as I was growing up. The war in Iraq and Bush really kind of turned him. And he's a great NPR listener. I can maybe attribute some of his political leanings now to National Public Radio.
Well, and we thank you for supporting us.
You're welcome. I took a lot of crap for that.
He's very independent minded.
Yeah,
he is.
So he also likes Bernie, but he also voted for Scott Walker. He saw that, you know what, he gets very concerned about the financials of the country. I would agree with Rachel. He is independent. But for me, they taught me how to think. They taught me how to think for myself, and they're really open to a great debate. So there's some things that my mother and I can talk about that we absolutely agree on, and there's some things that we just don't agree on, and we, you know, try to stay away from them. But I think they've raised their kids to be independent minded and think for themselves. And she kind of
makes for a fun Thanksgiving. I mean, truly,
yes,
when you're with the Duffys, it's a big family. It's a boisterous family. It's a fun family. It's a very athletic family. And they all have very different points of views. You know, some of them are small business owners. Some of them are teachers. Some of them are dentists. So there's a wide range of professions. One of them was the mayor of the town. So they have a wide range of points of view and experiences. They're all very connected to the town. They all meet for coffee every morning at the local coffee shop.
On Sunday morning. It's a
tight family with lots of points of view. And it was really a fun thing to come into that kind of a situation.
Wrapped in a lot of love.
Rachel, let's talk about your background growing
sure.
up in Arizona. You were one of four kids, and from what I've read, mm-hmm. your family faced some challenging economic times.
Well, so actually, I grew up abroad a lot, Glenn, because my father was in the military. So my father is Mexican American from Arizona. Grew up in a copper mining town in Arizona. And joined the military. And one of his first assignments, one of his earlier assignments, was in Madrid, in Torrejon Air Force Base. And he met my mother when he was in Madrid. So my mother is from Spain and my father is Mexican American. My father was a young airman with, you know, four kids. I grew up, you know, with my dad going to night school. I mean, it's interesting. We're so different.
He was an immigrant from Mexico? Or?
No, he was first generation born here.
Okay.
My mother is an immigrant, and she became an American citizen. So I grew up a lot like Sean. You know, my father was – I watched my father, you know, going to night school to get his bachelor's degree. I think my father figured out, you know, if he wanted his kids to live a middle-class lifestyle, that he was going to have to get an education. I think that's what they instilled in us, hard work, and that education was the gateway, the pathway for us to rise, you know, into the middle class.
You've been outspoken on issues that are important to Hispanics. You're involved with a group called the Libra Initiative. You're their national spokesperson.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly what is that, and what is the organization trying to accomplish?
We are a nonprofit, and our mission is to empower the Hispanic community by educating them on policies. We also provide services like English language courses, help people to start businesses, support them in policies like school choice, things that empower them to really access the American dream. So
the word Libra means liberty, correct?
Liberty. So
is there a political implication to that?
No, I think we're all about economic liberty. We feel that.
Well, that's politics, right?
It
there.
It is. There's a political component because there's certain politicians that support those ideas. You know, we believe in free markets. We believe in personal responsibility. And limited government, because as Hispanics, you know, we're very close to the immigrant experience. It's very clear why people leave, Latin American countries and come to the United States. And I believe through my own personal experience and my own connection to my community that they come here for opportunity. They come here for an American free enterprise system of government that gives them the ability to work hard and provide a better life for their families.
Go on, Sean.
Which is a very different economic template than the countries from which they came. Very different. They're not American free enterprise type systems, right. And it's led to a lot of poverty and a lack of opportunity, and that's why they come here.
The countries that they come from are full of cronyism. They're full of corruption. There's no reliability as far as the rule of law, property rights. These are things that Hispanics understand intrinsically are key to personal success and to earn success.
Well, is your message getting through? The idea of economic freedom, less government, that's a conservative Republican idea.
Yeah.
But Hispanics have been voting for Democrats. Mitt Romney only got 27% of the Latino vote. How do you square that with what you say is an experience that should make them want to support those ideals?
Absolutely. Well, messengers matter. We haven't had very good messengers on our part, which is why our organization is there and really presenting these ideas as apolitical. I mean, these are American ideas. They don't belong to the Republican Party and they don't belong to the Democrat Party. So one thing that we're doing is presenting them in a very apolitical way, as I think they should be. The other thing that we're doing is we're going into the communities. Conservatives, I think, have – nothing has lifted more people out of poverty than free market capitalism. Nothing has. And that's just a historical fact. But the conservative outreach to minority communities has been very short term. They come in, they helicopter in a few months before an election. They go, here we are, here's our ideas, and then they leave. And liberals and progressives have been much better at community organizing, frankly. They are in those communities, their permanent presence. They build trust. And so in a lot of ways, our organization is taking what the left has done really effectively. But we're presenting a message. And in my opinion and in our organization's opinions, the ideas and the services that are being offered by community organizations on the progressive side create more dependence and lack of opportunity and of the ability to rise out of poverty. And the policies that we are promoting, I think, empower people, liberate people, allow them to take ownership of their lives and rise up into the middle class and beyond.
To your point on the percentage of votes that Mitt Romney had, this organization wasn't really up and functioning the way it is today.
That's true.
But beyond that, I would argue that the Hispanic community, they believe in choice in education. They understand that a good education is the
Absolutely.
Best pathway into the middle class, and that if they're stuck in a poor neighborhood in a failing school, that you have liberal politicians that are looking out for the union as opposed to these young kids who want a shot at the American dream. So they believe in choice in education. They believe in upward mobility. They believe in hard work. They believe in the American dream. They believe in families. And so a lot of these messages really resonate with the Hispanic community. Now, I'll tell you, as a Republican, I look at some of the tone of my colleagues with regard to immigrants, and I think that's the root of why immigrants will not support the Republican Party, because they communicate in a way that is in a fashion that would say they don't like us.
Let's get into that right now. The front runner in your party is Donald Trump, and he's way ahead in all the polls. Now, I know it's early, but there was a new Washington Post ABC News poll released yesterday that found that Trump is viewed unfavorably by 82% of Hispanics, with 68% feeling strongly so. Just 15% of those surveyed viewed Trump favorably. You can't win the presidency if Hispanics, vote 83% for Democrats in that election. It's just statistically impossible in our changing country. How much damage is Donald Trump doing to the Republican Party right now?
I'll maybe talk about that in a second, but I think Rachel has some information just on where Hispanics are with regard to Donald Trump. I was surprised in some of the stories that she's told me of people who you might not think who are Hispanic that are coming out and saying, just in personal conversations, that they approve of what the Donald is saying.
I think it's a mixed bag. I think that, it's very clear that some of the things he's saying are not resonating at all with Hispanics. I do think that you know, first of all, Hispanics vote as independents, much more so than, say, the African-American community that pretty much is lock, stock, and goes in the Democrat direction. 55% of Hispanics have voted for a Republican at one point in their life. So they are much more independent.
When I was young, the African-American population wasn't that way. Back in the 50s, they were pretty much split between Republicans and Democrats. That's a recent phenomenon.
Right. My father was a Union Democrat, comes from a Union copper mining town. He voted for Ronald Reagan. That was his first time voting for a Republican. And
he's never looked back.
And he's never looked back. But it opened the door. And I think that once you get a candidate who can reach out, I mean, I think look at the field. I mean, we can focus on Trump. But if you look at this field, Glenn, it is the most racially diverse political presidential field in the history of the United States. And what makes me sad about where the conversation is going is that it's overshadowing this really amazing moment. I mean, we have an Indian American, two Hispanic Americans. We have an African American. This is a very diverse field, and we should be proud of that as conservatives.
All right, we'll get into that in just a second. But let me finish with Mr. Trump here. Okay, how do you react, Rachel, to this rhetoric?
Sure.
And this is a quote: "When Mexico sends its people, it's not sending its best. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people."
Look, the truth is that most Hispanics, whether they are U.S. citizens or immigrants, do not want to be lumped in with the felons that are coming across. I think that we should get rid of the felons and those who are dangerous. And we were told that Obama was going to prioritize deportations with those who were violent criminals. And that should absolutely happen, because what it's doing is it's tainting the good people who are coming up here just to work, just for opportunities. Granted, many of them have broken the laws. But the truth is that when I talk to Sean's colleagues, and I have talked to many of them, and we've had this conversation personally, the vast majority of Republicans want immigration reform. But it must start with in order for a compromise to happen, it does have to happen. It does have to start with border security. And then we can get to these other issues. But
Sean,
nobody is against reforming the immigration system.
Let me finish, Sean. Just a second. How do you react to this tweet from Trump about Jeb Bush? Jeb Bush has to like the illegals because of his wife. I mean, do you have to like the illegals because of your wife?
Are you illegal?
You know, Bush's wife isn't illegal either. This kind of rhetoric is awful for your party.
So listen, first of all,
he's a reality star, Glenn. Come on. I mean, at some point, let's be clear. This is he is somebody who is very bombastic, and that's how he wants to get attention. But that he represents the party, I mean—
He's been a Democrat most of his life.
I think you guys should own him.
I do think what
you guys.
Right. Oh, we know your
heart. Au contraire.
Newsflash, Glenn's a conservative.
But look, this guy, he's somebody who was for, not very long ago, partial birth abortion. He was somebody who was for
the stimulus bill.
The stimulus bill, Obamacare.
Not even Obamacare, single payer. These are all issues that your callers, and Brad is one who would applaud. These are liberal issues that Donald Trump has supported through the course of not his young life, but I mean,
these
very recent history.
Recent.
I think what's happening is a lot of conservatives are really frustrated with President Obama's overreach of the Constitution, doing things that aren't, in our perspective, authorized, but the Congress doesn't have a lot of authority to stop him. And Obama sees that, and he moves forward. And so that we haven't been able to stop the president when Republicans control the House and the Senate has been really frustrating, and I think rightfully so.
So Trump is speaking to that frustration.
No, what they're also frustrated in is that you don't have anybody in the leadership. I don't have a bully pulpit and a microphone like John Boehner does, or Kevin McCarthy, or Paul Ryan, or there's some people, or Mitch McConnell. There's some people in the leadership positions that could be far more vocal on the abuses from this administration, and they haven't been. And when you have a candidate who steps up and is boldly speaking and saying things that the conservative wing has wished that their leaders would say, they get behind him. They're applauding him. I think when you get back to the issues, though, about what has Trump supported in the past, is he really a conservative? Is he going to advocate, if he gets the White House, for the policies that you believe in? I think his history, the answer is no, that's not going to happen. And I think conservatives will probably swing from Trump to another candidate as we get closer to the
Are you saying that we need new leadership for the Republican Party?
What I'm saying is there's a frustration that those leaders haven't been boldly speaking out like conservatives want them to, like Rachel's mother tells me I should be doing from the steps of the Capitol.
We've got to take a quick break, guys. We're way over. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Great. Talk Radio. Our guests are Congressman Sean Duffy and his wife, television analyst and political activist, Rachel Campos Duffy. 1-800-780-9742. If you've got a question, that's 1-800-780-9742. We'll be back after this.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Florentine Opera of Milwaukee, La Lingerie, and Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts, proud sponsors of WPR programs. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. More information at wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Christine Bremer Moogley of the personal injury law firm Bremer & Trollope, committed to protecting the rights of accident victims throughout Wisconsin. Bremer & Trollope, because the right results matter most. Bremer-law.com.
I'm Glenn Moberg. We're back on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio with Congressman Sean Duffy and his wife, who is a television analyst and political activist, Rachel Campos Duffy. And we're talking a lot today about family and their personal backgrounds, trying to see what makes them tick. And we are also delving into the world of politics. 1-800-780-9742. If you'd like to join the conversation, let's go to Mary in Wild Rose.
Okay.
Mary, hello, Mary. You're on Route 51 right now with Sean Duffy and Rachel Campos Duffy.
Yes, hello. I have a question for the congressman. This morning I heard a whole lot of experts talking about this federal, you know, rate hike, the Fed and the rate hike, and pretty much it was unanimous that there has been no fiscal policy, that it's really important that Congress, and I remember that from my basic, you know, economics, that there has to be good fiscal policy, and that Congress has done nothing for the American people or the American, you know, the U.S. economy in close to 10 years. And I'd like to know it's not about being against somebody, it's about being for the country. And I don't believe Congress is working at the best interest of the country. And I don't think that anything you say, you know, I just think you're part of the problem.
All right, Mary, we got it. Sean, your response.
Thank you for the question, Mary. So the Federal Reserve deals with monetary policy. The Congress and the president are dealing with fiscal policy, which is taxes and spending. And the woes that we have had aren't you can't fix them through, you know, just printing more money and putting it out into the economy and low interest rates. There has to be fiscal policy that joins that monetary policy. And so to Mary's point, we try to put more money back in the pockets of American citizens with some decreases in taxes. And the president, not the Congress, is the one who is unwilling to join us in regard to tax reform. We put budgets out that actually balance within 10 years. And I think this is an important point, and not to get lost in the weeds, but we spend $240 billion a year to service our debt. So that's just in interest on the debt, $240 billion. We spend about $50 billion for HUD, the housing spending, $80 billion in food stamp spending, $50 billion in road construction or infrastructure spending, and about $550 billion on Pentagon spending. The amount that we're spending to service an $18 trillion debt is massive, and it's not going down. It's only going to go up. As interest rates rise and we continue to borrow more money, which I've been trying to vote against and try to reform the way we spend, but the trajectory is more spending, more debt, and higher interest rates means in the president's own budget proposal, at the end of 10 years, we're going to be paying almost $1 trillion in interest on our debt. Listen, that can help people, whether it's with houses, with schools, with bridges, that you will not be able to spend that money on because it's going to go just to interest. So we have to reform the way the system has worked. I've been on the budget committee. I voted for budgets that balance. We need Democrats to actually support it because when you have failing policies, failing governments because of too much debt, Greece is a perfect example. The people who are hurt the most are the poorest among us. The people who need some assistance from government are the first ones who feel the pain of a debt crisis. And so if you care about people and you care about sustainability, you have to care about fixing the debt. And I'll just argue to Mary's point, Democrats want to tax you more. They want to take more money out of your pocket and put it in the hands of bureaucrats in Washington so they can spend it.
Democrats,
I think that's the exact opposite.
Sean, Democrats will tell you that the president has reduced the deficit by 50%. How do you respond to that?
Well, we've in our own projections, we've seen that if the economy starts to grow, you'll see the deficit start to decrease. But the debt, Glenn, he's doubled it. The debt has doubled over the course of his presidency. So you got to look at the two numbers and not be skewed by the numbers. And listen, there's no end in sight. And with Medicare expanding and healthcare costs increasing, it's only going to get worse.
Let's go to Donald in Marshfield. Donald, you're on Route 51 with Sean and Rachel Campos Duffy.
Thank you. Just want to bring up the issue. You were talking about Mr. Trump earlier, and I think he's serving a very good function in one respect, although I disagree with about 90% of what he stands for. But he is serving a function in raising the issue of candidates being bought out by special interests. That's a huge issue. Obviously, the floodgates were opened by Citizens United. It was bad before then. It's awful now. And I think he's raised that issue, raising the issue that the Republican candidates as well as Democratic candidates are bought out by special interests and need to kowtow to people in California, New York, and billionaires such as the Koch brothers need to go and perform for them to make sure that they are in concert with their interests. This is one reason why 81% of people support background checks for gun ownership, and it's not even brought up in Congress because the big money is opposed to that. And I'd be interested in the comments that fact that Mr. Trump really has raised this issue, and I hope conservatives begin to talk about it and begin to talk about the ultimate answer, which is citizen financing through taxes of campaigns as opposed to billionaire financing.
All right, Donald, we've got it. Sean Duffy, your response.
So I think it is a good point to bring up. I don't agree with taxpayer funded of campaigns. I would support taking money out of campaigns, and you got to do it for both sides. So listen, you shouldn't have union members be forced to pay dues that are going to go to give to political candidates without the consent of the worker who is paying that due in. And we should have businesses as well that collect money from their employees and make those contributions also. You got to take all the money out. So if someone wants to give an individual contribution, let people give with whether you want to have certain caps or restrictions, that's fine. But you got to take all of the organized money out. And what I oftentimes find, Donald, is that you'll have some say, well, there's Republican money that comes in from these people and we have to take that away. That's bad for America. And I will say, well, how about this other money that funds Democrats through different kind of organizations? And they're no, that money's fine. That's clean, angel sent money. Listen, if we want to reduce money, I think we got to do it across the board. And for me, listen, if you live in central Wisconsin, for the last three elections, you've seen millions of dollars spent on ads run against me, negative ads, misleading ads. So if we could reduce a little bit of money, I think I would have a lot less painful ads
races. I think that was Donald's point. He said that it's a problem on both sides. And this business of negative advertising is terrible. It's amazing that anybody runs for political office with what you have to put up with.
See this gray hair, Glenn? That's what happens.
Yeah.
That's pretty great.
Who are you supporting for president? Are you behind Scott Walker, Wisconsin's native son? Rachel, you spoke at his kickoff.
I personally endorse Scott Walker. I think he has a great record, and I think that he obviously has the kind of fortitude and personal conviction where he can stand up to some of these influences that your caller is talking about. I think that he's somebody with a lot of courage, and I think that's what people are looking for.
Well, he's dropping in the national polls. On Sunday morning on national TV, he was asked to explain how Barack Obama is more popular right now in Wisconsin than he is.
Yeah. You know, it's early. I think a lot of people aren't following, and I think that, you know, it's fun right now. We'll see what happens.
Four years ago, Michelle Bachmann was leading in the polls. I mean, so this is going to change quite a bit. And I think, you know, we don't know who's going to be the lead. And even for the Democrats, I look at what's happening with Hillary Clinton. I mean, the heir apparent, you know, getting ready for Hillary and raising millions of dollars in a super PAC for her.
Gazillions of dollars.
And the fact that, you know, she has endangered the national security of this country because she was more concerned about herself and her privacy than she was about keeping documents secret. And so she's exposed those to the Russians, the Chinese, everyone who is sophisticated in their espionage, which many are. They have access to American secrets, which have been, I would believe, endangered American lives. And so I think Democrats are really going to have a far more interesting conversation. Are you going to go
Sanders? Yeah, look at the crowds that Bernie Sanders is drawing and Joe Biden is thinking of.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so I think Hillary, I think Hillary has problems. And, is she going to be indicted? Is she going to be forced to testify in front of a grand jury? I'm not sure. But I got to tell you what. As a member of Congress who gets a chance to see some classified information and have access to some classified information, this is serious stuff. And to say, when she's talking about saying, well, it wasn't marked classified. Well, if someone tells me, Glenn, classified information, and I know it's classified, and then I put it in my own email and send it out, of course I didn't mark it classified. And no one was there to classify it for me, but she is transmitting classified information on an unsecure server. This is anti-American stuff.
But also the conflicts of interest, the payments to the Clinton Foundation, and frankly, the hypocrisy of, you know, taking money from countries that are, you know, subjugating women, that are doing all kinds of human rights abuses towards women and children, and then
throwing gay men off buildings to kill them. I mean, horrible stuff that the Clintons are taking this money from them. And I would like to see, you know, some equal outrage from the left to go, you know what, hold up. As Americans, we're better than that. We want someone who actually is going to fight for the country, not just for their family.
Well, she is sinking in the polls,
and I
have talked to a number of liberal Democrats who are quite concerned about the points you're making.
Can I talk about Joe Biden for 1 second?
Yeah.
I'm not endorsing Joe Biden.
We are kind of running out of time.
Okay, but
so I'll
make it very quick. In Congress, the one guy that can actually work and cut a deal, the guy that at the start when I first got there, President Obama would send in to work with the House was Joe Biden. And Joe and I don't agree on a whole lot, but Joe could cut a deal. Joe could go, you know what? We can find a pathway where we can work together. We can both be winners. We can both be losers, but we can find solutions. Joe Biden was actually able to do that, which is why Obama took him off the negotiating team. But listen, I think he's going to be a far better Democrat choice. Not that the Democrats want my opinion.
I would fear Joe Biden more than Hillary.
Rachel, one more question about Scott Walker. All this talk about building a wall in Canada, and he says he was misconstrued, misinterpreted. That can't help him with Hispanics.
Canadians.
Yeah, I think that's going to bum out the Canadians.
But all of this talk about walls.
You know, I honest to God, I did not see the actual quote, and I have so many times heard my husband misquoted, so I have to go back and see exactly what he said. I didn't watch the interview where he said that, and like I said, I have had lots of experience of having my husband misquoted. I don't know. I have to hear what he has to say. I'll tell you this. He and I have talked about Hispanic issues. I've personally have no problem with the positions that he's taken on securing the border, but also he's talked about immigration reform, and again, Hispanics don't, this idea that Hispanics just care about immigration. Hispanics care about jobs. Hispanics care about education. This idea that you want to, you know, the left wants to pigeonhole us as this one issue, demographic is false.
How do you, again, react to the fact that Mr. Walker isn't doing very well with Hispanics in the national polls?
Well, I mean, he comes from a state where, the population is 6% Hispanic in Wisconsin, I think. Look, he's still new to the country. He's familiar to all of us here in Wisconsin, but he's still getting out there, getting his name out there. I know he's going to be doing some forums in the future, probably with Libre or other organizations, Hispanic chambers, just like Donald Trump is going to be doing, and we'll get more information about what his positions are. But I look at Scott Walker, me personally, not my organization, but me personally, I look at his economic agenda. I look at, you know, foreign policy. Again, Hispanics are a lot more dynamic than this immigration talk would have you think.
There's a lot of chatter there out there right now on both sides. I do think that the issues are going to focus. We're going to want to get a leader who can address the big problems that we face in America and around the world. And I think Walker has shown the grit to get big stuff done.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking to Congressman Sean Duffy and Rachel Campos Duffy. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Wesley Heating and Cooling, TDS Custom Construction, and the Mead Witter Foundation. You, too, can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Find out more at WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Northwind Renewable Energy, Stevens Point, with a focus on renewable energy system design and installation, including solar, wood, and deep energy retrofits to existing buildings. NorthwindRE.com.
I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network, and we are down to our last few minutes. Sean Duffy, are you looking forward to the Pope's visit later this month?
I am. I think we're going to have a great conversation. The first time a Pope is going to be on the floor of the House talking to the American Congress, a joint session, and to the American people. It'll be fascinating.
Well, how do you feel then about his 180-page climate change encyclical? And if I can quote from it, climate change is a global problem with grave implications, environmental, social, economic, political, and for the distribution of goods. It represents one of the principal challenges facing humanity. He says it causes a grave social debt to the poor, and he's calling on governments to take concrete steps to address it. If he makes that speech in front of the Congress, yeah, how are your Republican colleagues going to react?
What do you think about his position on life and marriage?
I've got that here, too.
Do you agree with that? So I think we're in a unique situation where there's a lot of people who want to try to pick and choose what the Pope says and try to hold that out as gospel, but not look at the other core teachings of the church. So we have dogma of the church, the laws and the rules of the church, which is in regard to life and marriage. This is a very strong opinion from the church, but it's not dogma of the church. I'm someone who believes
prudential judgment. I mean, Catholics, we have prudential judgment.
And this is part of prudential judgment. If he wanted to make this dogma or the law of the church, the Pope could have, but he didn't. Now, does that mean that we shouldn't look out for our environment? Absolutely not. We all want to make sure we have a clean, healthy environment. And it'll be fascinating how the conversation rolls out when the Pope comes. But again, in the encyclical, he does talk about dogma, and he does offer prudential judgment, which is open for interpretation and discussion, but it's not the law, and that's the realm that he puts global warming in.
He's made a big issue out of poverty as in his time as a leader of the Catholic Church. What if he calls on redistribution of wealth from rich people to poor people?
Well, listen, I would disagree with that. I don't think those policies ever work. I think the free enterprise system in America has offered more opportunity and more wealth and more upward mobility than any other system known to man. And those who redistribute wealth from, like, the countries in Latin America, they've actually they're failing. Their people are leaving those countries and they're immigrating to America.
They're getting on little boats and enduring the possibility of sharks and drowning just to get to our shores. I would say this. I think the bottom line message with the Pope is that he talks about the dignity of human beings. And at the core and at the center of the dignity of human beings is freedom. And I think that's the conversation that we should be having about freedom. And I also think that, lost in many of these things, people are cherry picking what they like on the right and on the left. You know, the Pope has clearly made a very strong statement about the environment, and I think conservatives should think about that and ought to consider it. On the other hand, he's also said man earns his dignity by earning his bread, and he said many things about the dangers of youth unemployment and systems of government, like the socialist systems we see in Europe, that are breeding a whole generation of young people who have not learned to work because they simply don't have jobs available to them. And he's also made very strong statements about the family and about life. And I think it's interesting that he's coming at a time when we're having this debate about Planned Parenthood and government funding of practices, of abortion specifically, which are things that a vast majority of Americans have a very, very moral objection to.
How do you feel about him saying that priests can forgive people who have had abortions?
That's all. So I think it's a wonderful thing. And Jesus's forgiveness and the church's forgiveness is for everybody. There's really not a huge shift in that. It's not in some sort of, I think some liberals are taking it as some sort of endorsement or softening on the position of abortion. It's really about talking about the forgiveness that is available to all of us.
Sean Duffy, you've been in Congress now for three terms. What's next for you? You're going to run for the Senate? You're going to run for governor somewhere down the line? Or are you going to represent this district for 40 years like your predecessor?
Not for 40 years. The answer to 41 years, no. But I'm really enjoying myself. I'm on a great committee that has a huge impact on our economy. I'm a subcommittee chairman on oversight. And I'm having a great time representing people in central Wisconsin and northern Wisconsin and western Wisconsin. And it has been an honor of a lifetime to fight for the people that I love and I care about. And I'm looking forward to continuing that, hopefully for a few years to come.
We want to thank today's guest, 7th District Republican Congressman Sean Duffy and television analyst and author Rachel Campos Duffy. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to our executive producer, Dean Kallenbach, and our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. A special shout-out today to our former executive producer, Rick Ryer, who has moved on to new challenges after many years with Wisconsin Public Radio and 11 years working with me on Route 51, which the two of us helped create back in 2004. Rick, it is an understatement to say that you will be sorely missed here. Thanks, as always, to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Next week on Route 51, we have got an amazing show for you. Live in our studio, Glenn Leonard of the Temptations, Joe Coleman of the Platters, Joe Blunt of the Drifters, and Landau Eugene Murphy Jr., the winner of NBC's America's Got Talent, talking about the staying power of the rhythm and blues music of the 50s and 60s, and they will be singing for you, performing a cappella live on the air. The four of them will be appearing next Thursday night at Century World in Stevens Point in a special celebration concert. If you missed part of this show, you can hear it again in its entirety this Friday evening at 7 on WHRM 90.9 FM Wausau. You can also listen online or download it at wpr.org/route51. Thanks again for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.